Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired Sunday, February 19th, 2017. This is episode 1365. Before we go to the show, though, a little reminder, our survey runs out at the end of the month, February 28th, and we really want to hear from everybody who listens. It helps us sell advertising so we can understand, not individually, I don't collect any personal information, but I want to kind of get an idea of who's listening. It also helps us figure out what kind of programming to do for you. If you don't mind, it takes about a minute, 2 minutes. It's a little shorter than it's been in years past. twit.tv/survey. I really appreciate it. It really helps us. twit.tv/survey. And now here you go. Episode 1365. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Try it free for 14 days at texture.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you? Good to see you. Leo Laporte here. I'm the Tech Guy. It's time to talk about technology, the internet, home theater, computers, the internet, home theater. What else? Oh, digital photography. Chris Marquardt will join us, our photo guru, a little later on, about an hour and a half from right now. We talk all those new things, too, that are changing the world, you know, like the Amazon Echo and, you know, the voice interface to your computer and virtual reality and augmented reality. That's the hot new hotness. I think we're pretty ADD. I think that's the problem. And so about this time last year, virtual reality, we were all excited because virtual reality is going to be the next big thing. And in 2016, we were going to get our first commercial virtual reality stuff. Like the Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive. Oh, this was big. Now we're jaded, right? Maybe just me. Maybe this is an occupational hazard to the tech journalist, the tech pundit. I think the world in general. Yeah, okay. Once you've done it, like, you're not going to do it over and over again, I don't think. I think it's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's cool. But you don't say, oh, I got to spend $1,500. I got to get one of them. No, you know, it's like, yeah, that's cool. That's nice. It's like 3D movies. That's nice. What else you got? Ultimately, really, no matter what the player is, the content has to be engaging. You can make a movie 3D, but if it's not a good movie, it doesn't matter. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, is always saying to me, Smurfs 2 is an amazing 3D movie. Well, good, but I don't want to watch it because I have no interest in it. Smurfs 2. I mean, it's not an amusement park ride. It's 2 hours, not 2 minutes. I don't want to sit there. Oh, look at that. That thing looks almost real. Who cares? If I want almost real, I could look at my life. That's almost real too. And it's sort of the same to me with virtual reality gaming, right? It's a gimmick a little bit. If the game isn't great. Now, if the game's engaging, I don't care. In fact, a really great game on a 2D screen in front of you, you know, a computer or, you know, PlayStation 4 or Xbox or something on a screen, if it's an engaging game, it's like reality. It draws you in, doesn't it? And you forget it's not real. Mm-hmm. So all these gimmicks to get us to think we're in the real world, they're just gimmicks because they're not, you know. We know. Come on, you know. You suspend disbelief, but you know, it's not really real. That's why it's making you queasy. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, like to talk about this stuff, the tech, you can also reach us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, on our website at techguylabs.com. The geek community awaits. Snowdrops in our chat room says, I'd rather watch a superb story in 360p and, you know, in television mode than a junky one in 4K. Of course, exactly. 4K is great. The first time it's like, ooh, isn't that pretty? And I know, I'll be honest, I'm kind of guilty of this because I have 4K a 4K TV. And when you get a 4K TV, just remember when you got an HD TV and you're kind of desperate. And that's when Mark Cuban probably did pretty well. He made a cable channel that had terrible content, but it was in high def. And so people watched it. It wasn't interesting, but it was in high def. Same thing. There's a dearth of 4K content, so I'll go on Netflix. You can search for 4K, or what I search for is UHD, because I want to have the high dynamic range, ultra high def. And I end up watching stuff like a documentary on Japan. I watched that for a while. See the crane fly through the cherry blossoms in Osaka. Tea is almost ready. But it was beautiful. It was beautiful. But how long are you going to do that? You do that a few times and then, okay, give me a story. I want something interesting. I think what it is the best virtual reality is your brain. Our brains are capable of making, you could read a book and think you were there. The book is the opposite of a 4K high dynamic range movie, right? The book is as far removed from reality as possible. It's just ink marks on a page. It's not 3D. It's barely 2D. It doesn't have, there's no color. And yet, when you read it, your mind can make it into something beautiful. So I think that sometimes, maybe this is because I'm working in radio, right? Radio, we have nothing. We have a sound. We have our voice. That's it. But if it's, do you ever listen to old time radio? It can be very engaging. It can be very real. In ways, I think it can be more real than a 4K movie, because if you're going to make a movie with all this technology, you got to spend a lot to make fantastical things happen. When people first saw The Hobbit, director Peter Jackson is one of the proponents in Hollywood for the new high frame rate movies. Not only super high resolution, yeah, of course, but also the frame rate's higher. And what happens is you get a hyper-realistic still picture. But what also happens is, unless you put a lot of money into the sets and the makeup, Hollywood can't get away with what it used to get away with. It used to be, you could do makeup and Gandalf's wand, his wizarding rod, could be made out of plastic. But on 24 frames per second, it looked real. As soon as you get to 120 frames a second, it looks like a piece of plastic. In fact, that was one of the reviews of The Hobbit, is it looks like you got it at Wands R Us in the bargain bin. It looks like it's made of resin, which it probably was. There's a movie Ang Lee made, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Again, same thing. He made it so high quality, it could only be seen in two different movie theaters, one in New York, one in L.A., for a very brief period of time. I was tempted to fly down to L.A. just to see it. But you know what? The movie closed almost right away. Why? Because it wasn't a great movie. It got, 56 on Rotten Tomatoes. So it didn't matter that all this technology was put into it. I point to the written page. The ink on a page can look more vivid, more realistic than the highest quality technology. I guess I shouldn't be arguing against technology in a tech show, should I? The thing I am interested, we've talked about it before, and again, Apple's Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, is really talking about this and pushing it, is the next thing, since we're already bored of the current thing, virtual reality, what about augmented reality, or sometimes they call it mixed reality, because it's your reality. You're looking through clear glasses at the world, but the glasses have the ability to superimpose on top of that imaginary things, creatures from another world. Or your user interface, menus, windows, kind of like Tom Cruise in Minority Report, where you're just swiping through data. All the science fiction stories have that kind of interface. That's, I think one should not underplay the influence of science fiction on Silicon Valley, on science in general. A lot of times we're trying to invent the things we read about as kids in science fiction, and that's one of them. We'll see. We'll see. My friend Robert Scoble, who's an ardent evangelist for virtual and augmented reality, says Apple's next big thing this year will be some sort of augmented reality device. We will see. And, you know, maybe it'll be another one of those squirrel. We'll get all excited, ADD things, and then, boom, we've moved on. Or maybe this time they'll put some really good content, really exciting stuff behind it, and it'll be really great. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Let's go to the phones. Enough of me. What about you? Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out. Good morning, Leo.
Good morning, Michael.
How's it going?
It's wonderful. How are you?
Doing all right.
Got my Soylent in hand and ready to enjoy a lovely day.
How do you like that stuff?
I'm the only one in the world who likes it.
Epson.
Okay.
I think I've gotten addicted to it.
I read a couple of things online about it before it was they were kind of selling them multiple places.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those Silicon Valley things. Can we make a I always had this thing that there should be people chow, because you can make food for animals that's a complete nutriment, not very interesting, but the animal can live on it. And I always thought, boy, it'd be nice if there were people chow, so I don't have to. I could just eat exactly the right things in just the right amount and not have to think about it anymore. And that's, I think, the closest this is supposedly people chow. We'll see. Right. And this is the one with half coffee. It's got coffee in it and L-theanine as well as the nutriments. So it makes it tasty, I think. People complain it tastes like chalk, which the plain one kind of does. But the good news is they've solved the diarrhea problem. That's their tagline. And now, less diarrhea. So, I never had that problem. I mean, I think one of the issues was they wanted to avoid, they wanted to keep, the original Soylent had a high glycemic index. So they wanted to cut that. Soy protein, sunflower oil. Oh, here's the sweetener. Isol maltulose. What could possibly go wrong? A slow metabolizing disaccharide synthesized from beets, much like sugar. Each bottle of Soylent includes 20% daily requirements of all essential micronutrients. Oh, I thought it was 300 calories. It's gone up. 400 calories now. Okay. They don't say sugars. Let's see these sugars. 36 grams of carb. But 9 grams of sugar, so I don't understand that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Now, when you call that number, a lovely person is going to answer. There she is, Kim Schaffer, the phone ranger. Hello, Kim.
Good morning.
Good morning. Are you a little soggy? Damp.
I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
I'm sick of not being able to leave the house.
It's so ironic because, of course, we've been suffering for 7 years from drought and complaining mightily about it. Mm-hmm. And then it rains. And now we can't wait for it to
And those
stop.
People down south are getting a little taste of it right now, too.
Yeah.
It's not just us.
Yeah. And then the dams break. And
oh, God. Yeah. We can't have any rain. We've got too much.
So you, I see been answering the phones. I see a number of calls. Who should I start with here?
Well, Greg in L.A., and he has a little issue that we all have with Apple taking things away.
Apple taking things
Making
away.
Making things go away from their products.
Oh, Apple. You're just so Apple. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good morning, Leo.
Good morning.
Been following you for years. Love your shows ever since Screensavers.
Thank you
for everything you do.
Man, I've been doing this a long time.
Yes, you have.
But I like it. I like it. It's fun to watch things change, you know?
It is. It is. I've been using Mac since the early days, the Mac, the original one. And I'm sort of the designated IT person at my small company. And we recently, we bought some of these new MacBook Pros with the magical touch bar and all the new swanky features.
How's the reaction been to those?
I'm getting problems with them because we loaded them up with RAM. So they have a lot of RAM in them, 32 gigs and terabyte
storage. Wait a minute.
Storage.
How did you do that? I thought they were limited to 16.
I believe the new ones are 32. Anyway, it's maxed out. And we're using it for some kind of heavy-duty 3D scanning applications and stuff. So we take them to trade shows and demo them. And my salespeople can't figure out how to turn them on and off. That sounds like a basic problem. But it's a basic thing that they took away the chime cord. So when you press the button, nothing happens.
Yeah.
You press it, and it's a black screen.
Yeah.
And it takes 15 seconds or so to complete the memory test. So you're just staring at it, wondering,
frustrated.
Is it on?
Yeah.
And they press it again, and sometimes they get frustrated and press and hold the button and then turn it back off. And
because they don't know what happened. Yeah.
Right. There's no feedback. There's
you're saying that chime, they're like Pavlov's dogs, but instead of salivating, they just sit there patiently when they hear that chime.
Right. And there also used to be a little LED on the front that would glow when it was on. They took that away. So you can't tell when the lid's closed if it's sleeping or you shut it
right.
down.
This is very Apple. That's so Apple because their position is you shouldn't even be thinking about that.
Well,
their position is
that
just don't worry. Let go and let Apple. We know what we're doing, and users should just – all they should really do is close the lid and open the lid, and everything else we'll take care of.
So right after we bought it, there was actually a little hack out there that you could type in the command line that would re-enable the
chime
cord. And then with the next software update, they took that away.
Did they take that away, the NVRAM hack?
Yes, they did.
You're kidding.
No. So I'm just wondering if anybody in the chat room or anybody else has any new ideas.
Because I was all about to say, in a very smug voice, if you go to terminal, you can turn it back on.
Yeah, we did been there, done that. But
it doesn't work anymore.
They broke it, yes. So we're frustrated. If anybody has any ideas, I don't know why they don't just put, they've got this touch bar. They could probably reprogram that to turn a little green dot on in the corner when you press the
button. You instruct your employees to turn off their laptops?
Well, we have to because, if you go to a trade show or something and you use it and then you just put it to sleep, it may be 2 or 3 days before anybody ever uses that machine again and it will go into a coma.
Right,
So,
and there are other reasons. Nowadays, if you travel overseas, it's my strong recommendation that you turn off all electronics before you try to get back into the U.S., because otherwise they'll open up the laptop and suck all the data out of it, or they at least have the right to do that. So
there's nothing on these are.
I know, but it annoys me. It's like I'm sorry, that's my stuff.
Well,
but they have the right to go through my bags too. So that's the rationale. It's just part of the reentry process.
Well, anyway,
there are good reasons to turn it off. I never turn mine off ever, but I always use it every day, right?
Right.
So there was a command. It's a terminal command. You have to do it as root, so you'll have to use the sudo command. And the command is nvram, which is the non-volatile RAM. And you're actually that's a program that will let you set parameters in it. And in this case, the parameter is boot audio, capital B, capital A, boot audio equals. And then you're going to do true, but because it understands hex, you do %01, or I guess that's octal, %01, which is the same as one. And that supposedly, I haven't done it on my new MacBook Pro, turns the chime on. But you're saying now with an update,
that no longer works.
Wow.
It used to work. Well, it's just like they took
why would they do that? That's I can understand them saying by default we're not going to do the chime. But I don't understand them eliminating a way that you can turn it on. Wow.
Well, I hope somebody from Apple is listening and
I hope so too.
There is a good reason.
I hope so too. And I'm going to check around and see if there's a new way to do it. I'll play with my Mac at home. Let me ask you about the touch bar. Do your your users like it or dislike it, or do they care?
We don't care. I mean,
you know, you're paying extra. That's $100 extra right there.
Half the time, these machines are booted into Windows 10. And,
which doesn't do anything, yeah.
You know, it could have been the regular function keys. We don't care about that.
Right.
But we did need the faster graphics processor.
Yeah, well, that's the reason. This is where you're caught between a rock and a hard place. I would prefer to stick with the old style. In fact, they make one with the old style, but it's too slow. If you want the fastest processors, the most RAM, the fastest hard drives, the biggest hard drives, you have to get one with the touch bar. The good thing about the touch bar is Touch ID, and I don't know if you guys use that or care about that or not.
We don't really use it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a nice feature to have if it's a personal machine and you have mail and things on it, but we don't use it that way.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, we don't have the problem that you've reported where you accidentally touch things on it.
Yeah, I had to.
Yeah.
So the upper left-hand corner by default is Siri and then the notifications panel, and it's right below the delete button. And I make a lot of mistakes. That's just me.
Yeah,
so I hit delete a lot. And it's not like I'm missing the delete button and hitting that other button, but if a little tiniest bit of your finger should just by chance, while the meat of my pinky is on the delete button, the littlest tiniest part should briefly swipe the Siri thing. It wakes up, says, yeah, what do you want? Hello. And I'm in the middle of doing something. So I find it very annoying. But nevertheless, this is something we suffer with. I will, chat room and I will both look for a way to re-enable the chime. I thought that NVRAM command would work. That's a little disappointing. But let me check for you. Hey, thanks for the call, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, said something to the last caller that I think raised some questions, at least in the chat room. We were talking about turning off your computer. I said, well, why would you turn off your computer, except maybe when you're coming back in the United States? And people said, what, huh? So let me explain that. And it's a kind of a convoluted story. But Customs and Border Patrol has always said, although courts have sometimes disagreed, there really isn't a definitive court case to my knowledge on this, that they have the right to, even if you're a U.S. citizen reentering the United States, they have the right to go through your baggage. Nobody disputes that. But they also have the right to go through your electronic devices, including your laptop, your phone, and in at least some cases, remove or suck all the data off your phone for later analysis. They have the capability to do that. They have also, lately, ever since the executive order of last month, they've said that they also have the right to get the passwords to your social media accounts so they can look at what you've said on social media. Now, I understand that the point of this is really to ferret out terrorists on their way into the country. We could debate whether the merits of that, but if you wish to preserve your privacy, there's only a few things you can do. If your computer and your phone are protected only by a fingerprint, in other words, they're on and a fingerprint will unlock it, most courts so far, although there are some dissenting opinions, but most courts so far have said that's the demanding a fingerprint is the equivalent of demanding a fingerprint when you get arrested. They take your fingerprints. It's no more incriminating than that, or giving up a hair for a DNA analysis. It doesn't infringe on your right against self-incrimination. The Fifth Amendment. You know, according to the Constitution, we have a right not to self-incriminate. And the courts have usually held, again, there's debate on this, the courts aren't 100% unanimous about it, but most cases they've held, that a password is protected. In other words, law enforcement can't be compelled or can't compel you to give up something you know in your head. They can't read your mind. They can't force you to divulge the contents of your mind. That's been traditionally held off limits. That's protected by the Fifth Amendment. So they can ask for something you have, like your fingerprint, but they can't ask for something you know. If you turn off your computer or turn off your phone and you've protected it with a password or even a four-digit PIN, the theory is that they can't compel you to give up that PIN or the password. So that would protect your devices. So that's the rationale some use for turning off their devices. Certainly I will do this. I will always do this. Turn off the devices before we come into the country. And then, by the way, being a U.S. citizen does not protect you in this regard. You are still subject to this kind of search if they decide. And the courts have also debated whether there should be probable cause or it could just be done at random, that kind of thing. I prefer not to have strangers go through my cell phone, personally. Now, what they can do, and they apparently have been doing, is detain you. Last week, a U.S. citizen who works at NASA, of all things, was asked to give up his cell phone for search by the Customs and Border Patrol. He was re-entering the United States. He'd been to some races in South America, some car racing in South America. He was coming back to the United States. He was a U.S. citizen, born in the U.S., worked for NASA, in fact, had a phone that wasn't even owned by him, but was owned by the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a government, secure government installation. And he had been told by the JPL folks that, you know, keep this phone secure because this, you know, this is our property and it should be secure. So when Customs and Border Patrol said to him, you must unlock your phone so we can examine the contents, at first he said, well, I can't. I can, but I shouldn't. This is a JPL phone. I'm a U.S. citizen. What are you doing? I understand that apparently what the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, and others are saying is, well, at that point you should call a lawyer because you do have the right not to unlock it, but you may be detained anyway. It is legal for them to detain you for a period of time. And I think most people, myself included, confronted with that might say, well, I just want to get in the U.S. There's nothing on the phone. Okay. And that's what this NASA scientist did. He said, fine. They took the phone, came back with it half an hour later. He is under the presumption that they actually used a device. There are several, but there's probably one made by an Israeli company called Cellbrite that you plug into the phone and it literally copies the contents of the phone. They have his entire life. They took it all and can do anything they want with it now. He, of course, when he got back, he's the reason I know about this is because he went on to Facebook and said, I can't use Facebook anymore. I can't use any of this stuff anymore because my phone's been compromised. I'm bringing this to the security folks at JPL. He said the security folks at JPL were very upset. he said, there's nothing on here, but nevertheless, this is, you know, a government phone. The upshot is they may say to you, yeah, even if you've turned off your stuff, okay, turn it on and give me the password. And it was, I guess, up to you whether you decide to fight for your rights, because you apparently, I think it's understood, you don't have to give them the password. You're protected by the Fifth Amendment. But you may spend some time cooling your heels in airport jail, which doesn't sound fun. Very complicated. And the courts have yet to really, I think this is going to have to be ruled on by the courts. I think if you turn your stuff off, there's a higher likelihood you won't be asked to turn it on and give them the password. But I could be wrong. It might be a red flag. Who knows? Who knows these days? 8888, Ask Leo. Johnny's in Pasadena. He's our next caller. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, Leo. Long time, first time.
Thank you.
Going
welcome.
Back to the ZD TV days.
That's the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
What can I do for you?
I'm having problems accessing Gmail, and I'm using Windows Vista. I'm able to access it at the library because they're using Windows 8. So I was just wondering if there's any relationship there. And
what happens when you try to go to Gmail?
I get a 502 bad gateway error, and underneath the 502 bad gateway, there's it's a lowercase nginx /1.6.1.
So nginx is the web server. The bad gateway means we can't get in. Gmail is blocked. You might ask the library if they're blocking it. The library may also be doing some little tricky stuff. Some places do this. You're on somebody else's internet, and what they may be doing is something called proxying, making you go through their server to Gmail. If Gmail sees that, it will probably block you because...
No. I am able to get to my Gmail through the computer at the library, but...
Oh, not at home.
Not at home. Not on my desktop.
Well, that's completely different.
Right. And now the only difference that I can see is at in my desktop at home, I'm running Windows Vista, and Google no longer supports Windows
Vista. First thing to do is check the date and time on your computer at home. Make sure that your clock is working. Sometimes older computers, with the battery goes, the clock goes, and if the clock's wrong, your certificates will appear out of date and insecure. That would be the first thing I'd look at. Remember, Vista is now unsupported, so you're on a pretty old operating system. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
So, sorry about that. I had to run, unfortunately.
Oh, no
problem. So, you're getting a 502 at home. So, it works. Of course, it works at the library. Okay. So, it could be because it's an older computer. You don't have a... You know what? That would be an interesting test.
It's a desktop. And so, the date is current. It gives me the correct time, correct date, everything. But... that's one thing. I'm able to, access everything on Google except the Gmail.
And you're, even if you hand enter gmail.com?
No, I didn't try that. I just clicked on the Gmail link.
I wonder if that link is bad.
Yeah, maybe. I'll Google.
Try going to gmail.com. What that error message is bad gateway means, I think you're getting to Nginx. You're getting to their server. That's interesting. But it's reporting bad gateway, which is 502. When I get that, it usually means that I don't have an internet connection. Let me just look real quickly what the technical means. One server on the internet received an invalid response from another server. Bad gateway. So that could be... that's interesting. What browser are you using?
I'm using Internet Explorer.
Yeah, that's
right. No. Actually, the browser, when I try to access Gmail, is Google Chrome.
You're using Chrome?
Yes.
And it's up to date, obviously.
Well, Chrome says, when I bring up my Chrome, right on the top of the page, when
it
first...
It says, we don't support Vista anymore.
Yeah, no, we don't support Windows XP or Vista.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it won't work. It just means they're not updating it anymore.
Yeah, right.
And it would behoove you at some point, if you could, to get to at least Windows 7.
Right.
I understand money's an issue, and nobody wants to spend $110 to get a new operating system that does exactly the same thing as the old one. But boy, that's an interesting issue. When I get this, and I've gotten it, usually means I have no internet. But you obviously have internet.
Yeah.
You've rebooted the machine.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
It was working until December. Then it stopped. I wasn't able to access Gmail in December. So and whenever I have to, want to check my email, I have to go to the library. So, it's probably time for a new computer then.
Yeah, or what you could do is get a free operating system, Linux, and put it on the Vista machine. It'll run quite well. And in a way, that would update your
okay.
Linux. So go to – what I would get is Xubuntu, which is a lightweight version of the most popular version of Linux. It's completely free. You download it. You put it on a USB key and you install it. Xubuntu.
Okay.
Xubuntu.org.
Xubuntu.org. Okay. And it's interesting. I tried to access Gmail through Firefox and through...
same thing.
Internet Explorer, same thing.
Same thing.
Same 502 gateway error.
Try just typing gmail.com in the browser bar just to make sure that it's not a bad link.
On the browser bar?
You know, where the thing where you type in addresses.
Right. Okay, so just put...
gmail.com, gmail.com works. Don't even do the www, just gmail.com is all you need.
Gmail.com, yeah. Okay.
See if that works.
Okay.
You did the right thing. You've tried all the different browsers. I mean, you've done everything right. I got to run, but I think that those are the next steps. Interesting. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. Spent a little more time talking with Johnny about his issue. I think I'm not sure what's going on. When I get that error, 502 error, usually it means I'm not online. Is what it usually means. But he's online because he can, and he's tried different browsers. I think it might come down to Vista, but I just don't know. He says his date and time is right on his computer. I don't know. What do you think? 8888-ASK-LEO. The chat room, irc.twit.tv. There's also a website where you can put, thoughts or comments. That's where we put all the answers, questions, and audio and video after the show, by the way. TechGuyLabs.com, and that's free. There's no sign up. For leaving a comment, you have to create an account. Actually, just use your Google account or your Facebook account or your Twitter account, just so that we eliminate spam. That's all. I don't collect that information. TechGuyLabs.com. Cynthia is in Burbank. Hi, Cynthia. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I just bought the Amazon Echo yesterday.
Yay! And are you excited?
Well,
no, not
I
at all.
Was, and I also bought the new Amazon Fire Stick.
Wow, you had a shopping spree.
I did, because I have the older Amazon, the little block.
I hear a but in there. Are you having problems with it?
Well, it doesn't open Netflix. It doesn't open Hulu. When I ask for, give me some new release movies, she doesn't say, like, she has that information.
So you mean with the Echo, you're trying to control the Fire Stick with the Echo?
Yes.
Does the Fire Stick work without the Echo?
Yes.
Okay. So it's the issue of talking to the Echo to get the Fire Stick to do the right thing.
Right. And I Googled it this morning. It says you can't pair the Amazon Fire remote with the Echo.
Oh. Yeah, I've never tried this, so I should probably try this. I do use the Echo to control the Logitech Hub, which is the Harmony Hub, which is a similar idea. And the way that one works, you pair it via Bluetooth, I think. So first thing to do, of course, is to go into the Echo app. They call it with the A word,
yeah.
But I don't like to say that word because it wakes them up.
Right.
Don't want to wake them up. Shh. Echoes are like babies, sleeping babies. You don't want to wake them up. But if you go into that app and go to the skills section and search for Fire Stick, I presume you have to add it as a skill. Have you tried that?
I tried to add Open Netflix and Open Hulu as a skill, but I didn't try.
Yeah, I think that's a separate. I think that's separate. Let me just look real quickly. How to use. Well, see, they talk about the remote being having the Echo Assistant inside the remote. But what you want to do is use that your black tube, your Amazon Echo with it, right? Yeah, let me just look real quickly and see what Amazon says. It may be. I wonder if it's a third-party skill. Does anybody in the chat room do this? If you have a I apologize because I've not done this, but I think it might. I think. What made you think it could do it? That would be the first
That's
question.
True. I'm wondering if maybe I should go back to.
The reason that they say the Amazon Fire Stick with the A word or with Echo is because that's in the remote.
Yeah.
You could talk to the remote.
So
you don't really need the Echo to do that. You just press the mic button on the remote and say, "Open Netflix."
Yeah. I think maybe I need to return the Echo.
I think you may not need the Echo is what I'm saying. Is that the only reason you got the Echo?
Yeah. Basically, the Echo seems to be a $180 theory.
Yeah, so I like the Echo, but, you know, if that was the only reason that you wanted it, just press the button on the remote and you can talk to it.
Yeah.
And now it does say that there is a Echo skill. I'm looking here. It's on the newer Fire Stick, but you just got it, so you have a newer Fire Stick.
Uh-huh. It said with the A word.
Yeah.
On the box. With the A word.
Yeah, but that works with the A word on the box because that's in the remote. The A word's in the remote. But let me see. But so it would be nice to do it completely hands-free, though, right? Because you have to pick up the remote, press the button, and then ask for Netflix.
That was the whole purpose.
Yeah. I'm going to have to do some research here and see if... Yeah, that's the one where somebody's saying, oh, yeah, Gary Busey. Remember the ads where Gary Busey was talking to his TV? But he was doing that into the remote. He was talking to the remote. Before you can echo, I'm looking at an article. There's got to be. So the thing is, here's what I would do. I can't for sure say this will work, but this is how it would work if it did, is to go into the Echo app and go to the skills section. You know, in settings, there's skills. And this is how we add capabilities to the Echo and search for Fire Stick. And see if there's a Fire Stick skill.
Okay, I'll try that.
Yeah, before you box it back up and send it back. Yeah. And by the way, for future reference, rather than getting the $189 black tube, my recommendation when you're going to get an Echo is get the $50 dot. It does everything it does everything the black tube does. It just doesn't have the bigger speaker on it. But you can connect it to a speaker. I'm sure you have speakers lying around. You can connect it to a powered speaker. It has a little speaker, which is enough for many people. And if all you wanted to do was, for instance, turn on the TV, it would do all of that for $50 instead of $180.
Okay.
All right. And I'm going to look into this and see if we can figure this out. Because and nobody in the chat room seems to have tried this either. I have a Fire Stick at home. You do have to have the Fire Stick version 5.05 software, the update on that. But if you have that operating system, the version 5.05 operating system or later, supposedly you can do it with an Echo. Well, I'll have to just check into it and see. I have a Fire Stick and I just don't use it because I have so many. How many ways does one have to watch Netflix after all, right? How many do you need? I can watch it on my TV. I can watch it on my Roku. I can watch it on my Apple TV. I can watch it on my Shield. Dr. Seuss should write a poem. I wish he could. Take a break for the news at the top of the hour. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up in about half an hour. Lots more of your questions, too. Lots more of my answers, I hope. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you can still call us. Just use Skype out or some sort of VoIP solution that lets you call regular phone numbers. Shouldn't cost you anything because it's a toll free number. 888-827-5536. Website techguylabs.com. Techguylabs.com. Jeff in Los Angeles is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Great.
Anyway, I have Hotmail email account, and I'm getting a lot of spam. I probably went to some...
No, it's normal. You know, actually, the truth is, I don't know what the current statistic is, but something like 80 or 90% of all email traffic is spam. So it's normal to see spam unless you have a good spam filter. And the reason we're kind of blissfully unaware of spam is because most systems have good spam filters. Apparently Hotmail, not so good.
They have a terrible
That's so good. So you have a couple of choices. You can upgrade your Hotmail to the new Outlook.com, and I bet you they have better spam filters on that. But that that might cost you some money. The other choice, and I gather this is what you're interested in, would be to move to Gmail, which does an excellent job on spam fighting.
Yeah, is it difficult to move the contacts, you know, and all my information in Hotmail over to Gmail, or do I have to input it manually by myself, data entry it?
No, you don't have to do it manually. It's not trivial, but it's fairly easy, and of course, you only do it once. And truthfully, it's nice to be in the Google ecosystem because all phones, including the iPhone and Android phone, and even Windows phone support it. So once you get your calendar, address book, and email into Google, you're kind of in the majority user case, right? So it's best supported. Easy to do. The first thing you need to do is create a Google account if you don't already have one.
I do. I have a Google account.
One of the reasons Google does such a good job fighting spam is because it's crowdsourced. So you'll note that when you're reading your Gmail, at least on the website, there's a button that says, this is spam. And there's so many Google Mail users now that when they, I shouldn't say the G word, my phone just woke up. When the Gmail users see spam, they mark it so. Google keeps track of that. And when enough people say, hey, this is spam, they say, good, we're not forwarding that one along anymore. So they're nearly 100% effective in my experience. If I used to use a commercial anti-spam service filtering my email, I stopped. I didn't need it anymore because Google does such a good job. So I, in fact, mostly use Gmail as a spam filter and then use another service to hold my mail and to access it.
But you found no difficulty in moving.
No. So what you're going to do, so there's two ways to do it. Gmail, what I would recommend is keep your Hotmail account. And when you go into your Gmail account, if you go into pop and forwarding or something, mail and forwarding, you'll see that you can get your mail from Hotmail into the inbox at Gmail. When it does that, by the way, it'll filter out spam immediately. So you won't see that spam at all. And then just access your mail through Gmail. That way you don't have to tell anybody your new email address if you don't want to. Or you can gradually migrate people over. Say, you know, don't write me at Hotmail anymore. Write me at gmail.com. So if you go in the Gmail settings, you'll see you can either collect the mail from Hotmail, or you can have Hotmail forward the mail to Gmail. It's kind of up to you. I think that the easiest would be just for you to have every hour or so Google goes out and gets your mail from Hotmail.
Really? And then just keep all the spam in the Hotmail account? Is that it? Just keep all the...
Well, just ignore it. Eventually, what you're going to do is you're going to tell people use your Gmail. You're going to have a new email address as your Gmail account. Actually,
oh, so I'll be eliminating my Hotmail account.
Eventually, over time.
I see. Okay.
But for now, this means there's no disruption. Anybody who mails you at Hotmail, real people, will get through to Gmail. Only the spam won't.
I see. Okay. Well, I'll work on that. It sounds like a
problem. As for calendar and address, I don't think it will automatically pick it up. You probably have to one time only export your Hotmail address book and your Hotmail calendar, and then import it into Google Calendars and Google Address Book, Google Contacts. And there's menu commands on both sides to do that. Just export and import.
All right. Enjoy the Academy Awards in a week.
Is it next week?
Yeah, well, the end of the last Sunday in February.
Wow. Are you up for an Oscar, Jeff?
No, not this year.
Well, good luck anyway.
All right.
You never know. Does that ever happen? They say, hey, by the way, you know, we had all these nominees, but look, Jeff won. Does that ever happen? Like the voters just do a write-in vote? That would be cool. I did interview one of the nominees for a short. It's called Pearl. It's really interesting because it's a virtual reality short. It's the creator of it. Made it in a 2D fashion. So that's how the Oscar voters will be seeing it. I doubt they're going to put on the visor. But there is he did it with Google and the Google Spotlight Stories. Have you seen that app? By the way, great app, iPhone or Android, Spotlight Stories. Because these stories, and the one he did, Pearl, is a really sweet story about growing up as a musician. And it takes place entirely inside a car. And that helps with the virtual reality because you're sitting sitting shotgun in the car and you can look around and kind of live vicariously this life as she grows up. It's wonderful. 5 minutes. And if you get a chance, you can, you know, you could use your Google Cardboard or your Daydream or your Samsung Gear VR if you have one of those. Otherwise, you could just move your phone around and you can look around by just turning your phone. Yeah, that's how it works. It's in Spotlight Stories. A bunch of other stuff. Filmmakers are using it, trying interesting new ways of creating content. Pearl's really good. I'll be rooting for him next Sunday, that's for sure. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, I mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. Here's how I do my email. After many, many years of struggling with email, and I recommend this for everybody. First thing is get a custom domain name that you own. And the reason is you don't have to ever again give out a new email address. You can get a domain name you like, maybe, you know, your last name dot mail or something like that. You know, leo@laporte.mail, something like that. Register that. You own that. Typically $10, depends if you get a fancy name or not. $10 a year. And then the domain registrar will have a way to forward mail that comes to that address. So you give everybody your, mine's leo@leoville.com. So I give for years that's been my email address. I give them that. But then I set up through my domain registrar, whenever anything comes to leoville.com, even if it's not Leo, anything at leoville.com, just send that over to Google. Send it to Gmail. So it's immediately forwarded to Gmail. And the reason I do that is because of this great spam filtering. Although, because Gmail kind of has a lot of storage, I just leave stuff there. And that has great search. So anytime I need to find an old email, I'm probably going to do it on Gmail because I know I'll be able to find it very quickly and easily that way. So Gmail is kind of my dump of email, filters out the spam, and then I pay for an email service from a lovely Australian company called Fastmail. Highly recommend them, but it's not free. For most people, you could stop with the Gmail, right? But I want an IMAP server for a variety of reasons. I have a lot. Fastmail lets me do a lot more filtering and mostly sorting of the mail, right? So I have dozens of rules and folders and all this fancy setup. That's all on Fastmail. Fastmail gets the mail from Gmail, sorts it, and then I use Thunderbird or Apple Mail or some other client, MailMate on the Mac, to download the mail from Fastmail. So if you send something to leo@leoville.com, it bounces right off, goes to Gmail. Gmail takes all the spam out of it. Then it goes to Fastmail, and that's how I get it. And that's worked quite well for me. I don't see any spam anymore, and I have lots of organizational stuff in there that helps me find the right stuff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
Thank you. Just last night, I was looking for something to read, and I thought, oh, wait, I bet I have some good stuff to read on Texture. And I did on my iPad. I love to. Have you played with Texture? Texture is Netflix for magazines. I think that's the easiest way to explain it. You can find out more if you go to Texture, T-E-X-T-U-R-E, like texture.com/twit. In fact, we've got a free trial there for you. Netflix for magazines, more than 200 of the best magazines for one low monthly price. And, you know, there's always something great to read. Okay, I admit, last night I was looking at the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. Couldn't help myself. Yes, Sports Illustrated is in there. So is National Geographic. So is Better Homes and Gardens. So is Vanity Fair. All the stuff I want to read. There's a great article, no matter what. Popular Science, Travel and Leisure. I love travel stuff, so I read a lot of travel stuff there. TEXTURE.com/twit. They also have, besides, you know, all the great magazines, New Yorker, yep. The Atlantic, yep. Time Magazine, yep. They also have some curated sections, so if you don't know what you want to read, but you know there's a subject you want, you can jump right to it, find some great articles. The problem with magazines, there's such great writing and reporting being done for magazines. Wired, Kevin Kelly's stuff in Wired. But I don't want to subscribe and have the guilt, right, of piles of magazines or the clutter on my coffee table. And, you know, I'm not going to go out and buy a single issue because that'll add up. For the cost of less than two issues of your favorite magazine, you can get all the magazines. There's also bonus features like movies, videos that, you know, you can't get in a magazine. Plus, I have to tell you, if you like photography, National Geographic or Vanity Fair, these look much better on your iPad than some screened, printed version of that image. They have all the photography magazines, too. I love texture. You will, too. I want you to go to texture.com/twit, texture.com/twit, and try it free. One of Apple's 2016 top iPad apps, 200 magazines, normally $10 a month. That's a great deal. What are the photography magazines? They have popular – I love this. So, again, another example of an outdoor photographer. I haven't looked at that. Where it's going to look better on your tablet. iOS, Android, texture.com/twit, 14 days free. Oh, I didn't tell you the best part. 5 devices per subscription. So Lisa and I share our subscriptions. And, you know, you can you favorite the magazines you want. It'll automatically download them. So you always have the current edition on your iPad. Back issues as well. Texture.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Our fine sponsors. They do have tech magazines. PC Magazine, Macworld, Wired, a lot of tech magazines. Hey, Chris Marquardt.
Hello, Leo.
I hear you. You hear me. Did you ever figure out what happened the other day?
No, it was Skype, but I'm now updated from 7.44 to 7.46.
Oh.
It says improved and faster and
must be true.
Release notes. I take that back. They haven't really released the release notes for that one yet, so whatever.
Well, we'll be with you in a little bit. And do you want to do a review yet, or what are we doing?
I have a chat room Q&A session. I have a whole bunch of questions live from the chat.
Coming up. Thank you, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. The phone number. Mike in Wichita. Hi, Mike. Leo Laporte.
Hey, Leo.
How are you today?
Doing very well.
Great. What can I do for you?
I'm in building what is probably going to be my forever home. And I have the ability to run data cabling throughout the house. And what I'm wondering is, where am I going to get the most bang for my buck?
Yeah.
And what can I do to future-proof it as much as possible? Should I run Category 6, 6A, or even 7?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been answering this question for at least 20 years. And the answer, you know, so the question to ask is, well, did the answer you give 20 years ago, did that suit? No. You know why? Wi-Fi suddenly popped up. And I've been telling all these people, it's a lot of money to put cabling in there. Get the cabling. And then everybody said, well, I'm just going to go wireless. I don't need anything. So the problem is you don't really know. I mean, you may in 10 years or 20 years, you may say, oh, I really wish I'd put fiber optic cable in there. Right? You don't know. So my advice is put conduit in. Put tubes in that you can draw cable through so that in 10 years, when fiber optic replaces copper, you go, oh, yeah, it's time, and you just thread it right through. So that's the first thing I would suggest. Don't just put wires in there. Put a tube in there. Put conduit in there. And make sure your conduit is obviously big enough to accommodate a variety of wiring. Cat 6, so if you look at the different categories, we used to, probably 20 years ago, I said, put Cat 5 in there. You'll never need more than 10 megabits a second, right? Wrong. Cat 5e, 100 megabits. Cat 6, Cat 6e. We have cabling in our studio, and I wish I could say it's our forever studio, but I hope it's our forever studio. We spent enough money building it. It's capable of 10 gigabits. I can actually copy a gigabyte a second, right? 6A. It's 6A, and that's the pink stuff. I don't know why it's pink. I think you have choices. Pink is SDI? Oh, okay. Blue, it's blue. Okay. John Slanina, my studio engineer, 6A. And one would think 10 gigabits a second. Why, you'd never need more than that, would you? And Bill Gates said we'd never need more than 640 megs of RAM either.
Right.
So you just, you know, the future-proofing is putting conduit in. However, and then the difference is really going to come down to price, because you'll see there's a big price jump when you go from 6 to 6A, when you go to from 5E to 6. So I, you know, if you are going to, let's think about what would be the use. I mean, obviously it's for the internet. It's for moving data around. Your internet connection probably isn't going to get better than a gigabit for a while. So Cat 6 would probably be sufficient for your internet connection. But then, you know, who knows? Maybe you're going to start editing 8K movie video and want to send it from the upstairs server to the downstairs editor. Then you'd want 6A. So it's hard to predict. Times change. I wouldn't put fiber in now. That'd be very expensive. Not so much for the fiber as for the endpoints. The switches are very expensive. So if I were building a house right now, I'd first of all, I'd have a wiring closet. I'd have a place for all those servers to live and for all that wiring to terminate. I'd make sure that we have, a conduit leading to every room. And of course, you know, for today, I'll put Cat 6 or maybe in there, or Cat 6A. Somebody's saying Cat
6. We have the conduits planned.
Good.
So that is going to be run throughout the house. In the house I'm in now, I'm running mesh Wi-Fi.
Well, exactly. See?
What do I want to put inside the conduit?
Every time I do Wi-Fi, though, for video, especially 4K video, or for certain demanding applications like VoIP, you know, voice like Skype, I wish I had wired, because wired is the most consistent. So in my opinion, if you can afford 6A, 10 gigabits per second, that should hold you for a while. I mean, okay. I can't imagine needing more than that, but again, times change, and maybe we'll... Now, somebody's saying Cat 7 is the same price, so it really is going to come down to your budget and how much you want to put in there. Truthfully, a gigabit's probably enough. Cat 6 would be enough. But you get that's the conversation. How much do I want to spend? Conduit's the future-proofing. And I do think glass is the future, ultimately. One strand of fiber can handle all the traffic you could throw at it, and then some.
Yeah, that fiber, I've done the research on that. That's getting cost prohibitive.
It's the endpoint.
So when you're looking at switches and
that's what's
and
expensive.
Anything that can support.
Because it has to handle a lot of bandwidth, yeah. We have a 10 gigabit connection to the internet here, thanks to SonicNet. Thank you, SonicNet. 10 gigabits. But no computer can handle more than one.
Right.
So I wasn't talking to you, Echo. So she thinks she can handle more than a gigabit. No, you can't. So I would say Cat 6 is fine, and conduit's the key.
Okay.
All right,
very good.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, and you got to think of jacks. And somebody said, well, Cat 7's no more than 6, but the Cat 7 jacks are more. See? You see what I'm talking? It kind of is you got to think budget, ultimately. Richard in Sonoma. Hi, Richard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi there. I have a question regarding, I'm working with a neighbor of mine. I'm the sort of area tech support person.
Nice. And good for you.
Yeah, thank you. Joy.
Joy. Don't ever let them know you know how to do this stuff.
I'm sorry I ever said, I can help you with that.
Well,
oh,
we're geeks. We want to say that, right? This is easy.
I have a friend who knows a lot, but his answer is, I don't know.
Famous,
it's not my thing. And it's an amazing, brilliant move. I made the mistake. So they've had T-Mobile VoIP service for a long time, which is an obscure service, not that many people even know it exists. You could get it. It was called At Home, cost $10 a month.
I didn't know about that. I've been a T-Mobile customer for years.
I know. Well, they had this obscure service. It was out for about 10 minutes. I bought a box and installed it for me, worked great, got it for my neighbor, and now T-Mobile's sending out a letter.
Oh, they're discontinuing it. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So I'm wondering about UMA. or something like that.
Uma's a very good choice. I didn't talk about Uma a lot when it first came out because it was a peer-to-peer system that was ultimately going to succeed or fail depending on the number of people who used it. Any peer-to-peer system works better when there's more users. But it's now to the point, A, I don't know if they're fully peer-to-peer still, and B, a lot of users. So, and everybody I know who has Uma is very happy with it.
And are there any downside? I know we don't ideally want to be using VoIP because if you lose power...
Right. That's the downside.
No,
you don't have real 911. So emergencies are a problem. Power or internet goes out, you lose phone. But everybody nowadays has a cell, and that's kind of solved that a little bit. It's not so 911 is still a regional thing, but you can tell your cell provider what your home address is. That helps. And right. When the power goes out and the internet goes out, the cell often continues to work. Nothing is going to be like the old Ma Bell that worked through a hurricane. And even Ma Bell doesn't work through a hurricane anymore. So I'd say Uma is a great choice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
Ooma. And the chat room is concurring. Everybody loves Uma.
Okay.
Yeah.
Am I still with you, Leo, or did I go?
Yes,
away?
You're still with me. We're just not on the radio or on the podcast
okay,
at this point.
Yeah. So can I ask a completely separate question?
Certainly.
So you're all in love with your Android TV, your Shield Android.
The Shield
TV.
Is awesome.
I have a Shield tablet, which
different.
I love. It's like... Why do you have anything else but the Shield tablet?
I know.
With a stylus.
I know. It's a good tablet. I know.
Now, can I use that as an Android TV, or do I have to buy Android TV to have Android TV?
Yeah, it's different operating. It's Android, but it's a different version of the operating system. And the Shield has Netflix, Amazon. They just added Amazon. The nice thing about the Shield is GeForce Now. Do you have GeForce Now on your Shield tablet?
I don't yet.
Yeah, that's awesome. So that's okay. A subscription, $8 or $9 a month, and you get access to a variety of games free, and then you can pay for it. It's the only way I could play No Man's Sky because I don't use a PC or a PlayStation. And it's great. It works really well if you have enough internet.
Okay. But you really like you. I know you have, like, you know, every day.
I have them all. You know,
you have them all.
Roku would be the next best thing.
I've learned about the Android, you know, TV a lot.
Yeah, you can talk to it. It has the Android App Store. Roku Ooh. Probably has more channels. But,
yeah.
So it's, you know, nothing's perfect and everything's different. But I think for the price, and the Shield is much more expensive than Roku. It's twice as much as a Roku. But
right.
I think for the price, it's the same chip as in your Shield tablet.
Okay.
Is it a K1 or the X1? I can't remember what they put in there, but
I think it's K1.
It's
I think
the
K1. K1.
I think it's the same chip, which means it's suitable for gaming, certainly big screen gaming anyway. Huh. And I've just been very happy with it. Yeah, I think it's a really solid thing. Is it twice as good as the Roku? Well, depends what you're doing. I would not play games on the Roku. They claim you can. I would not. On the other hand, the Roku has a lot more channels you can add. The Roku store is kind of rife with channels.
Right. I have a Roku, and I won't. I feel very much like Charlton Heston. You'll have to pry it from my cold dead hand.
I think you'll feel this. If you like the tablet, you'll feel the same about the Shield TV.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason that I am taking my Roku to my grave is because the remote with the jack for the headset.
The Shield does the same thing.
Oh, cool. Okay, awesome. Because that is life-changing.
When I got the Shield, it only came with the gaming controller, and you had to buy the remote separately. I think the new Shields come with the remote. But you want the remote because that has the headphone jack.
Awesome. I love that. That's a life-changing thing.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yes, I agree with you 100%. Because then you can, you know, it's late at night. You want to watch, you know.
Whatever.
Something that's exploding without having the police come to your home. Perfect. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Perfect.
Watch another Bruce Willis movie.
It's
where,
perfect,
you know,
for, yeah, Die Hard 8.
Right.
So, no, I think the Shield is elegant. It's a great UI. It's fast. It's kind of the reason I sing its praises is because it's unknown.
Right.
You know, Apple TV is certainly better if you're watching iTunes. It's the only one you can watch iTunes on. Roku has more channels. But if all you care about is Netflix, Amazon, Vudu, It's missing a few things that Roku's got, but you got a Roku.
But I got a Roku.
You got a Roku.
I'm like a little mini me, you know, Leo. I don't have the footprint, but I have the desire.
I'll tell you the weird thing for me, and it's just a Comcast thing. Comcast allows you to use HBO.
Comcast.
Yeah, I hate them. They allows you to use HBO Go on the Roku, but not on the Shield. You know, you have to make a deal with Comcast before they'll let you use HBO Go. And you can't do it on the Shields. It's really frustrating. It's little things like that. But that your mileage may vary depending on your locale. You're in Sonoma, so you're probably... Are you Comcast?
Yes.
Yeah. So
I mean,
you'll,
yes.
So you'll have the same problem.
I love Comcast.
You can't put HBO Go on there. Hey, I got to run.
Thank you.
Take care. No, I knew. I go right up to the zero. Mama, don't take my coat to Chrome. It's time once again to visit our intrepid photographer man, Chris Marquardt. He's the host of the fabulous Tips on the Top Floor podcast. He joins us every week to talk about digital photography. He is off next week for Siberia. What did you do to get sentenced to Siberia?
I chose it myself. I chose my own sentence.
Oh, man. Are you going to the gulag? What are you doing?
No, a photo tour with a whole bunch of people. We're going to go to Lake Baikal, which is the the biggest, largest, sweet freshwater lake in the world. And
when old Joe Stalin didn't like somebody, that's where he sent him. So
I know.
Yeah.
But in summer, it gets really hot. In winter, it gets really cold. We're going to be somewhere in the middle. So
we'll have a
frozen over lake and probably 6 feet of ice under us. So
now, we have recorded some segments, so we'll still have Chris while he's in Siberia. And we still have the assignment to take a picture that illustrates the word, the concept, the idea, break. We won't say how you spell it even. Just what we want you to do is to take a picture. You can take many, but you'll be able to upload no more than one a week to our Flickr group, the Tech Guy group on Flickr.com. Free to join. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will accept your picture. And when you get back from Siberia, you can pick some good break pictures to talk about. Now, you've got questions from the chat room today.
I asked the chat room for photo questions, and we'll do a semi-life chat room Q&A, and let's dive right in. User Sky asks, any tips on taking apart a compact camera to clean dirt from the inside of the lenses?
Yikes!
So there's a lot going on in that camera and small cameras, and it's kind of, I mean, you have to be good, and you have to probably try to get a repair manual and have very small tools and very good eyesight and practice a lot. I mean, that's kind of the thing.
Apart, no problem. It's putting them back together.
I mean, the question is, does it show on the photos? Is there any dust spots on the photos, or does it just bother your OCD? Because seeing that dust speck in there doesn't necessarily mean that it will show in a photo. So
my general advice for any camera is
bring it to the service.
Bring it to the camera. If you have a good camera dealer, they'll send it back to the manufacturer. Always the best way to clean.
Right. Mick asks, what are good standard settings on a digital SLR for shooting sunscapes? Sunset and sunrises are washed out. Same for moonshots. So for sunsets in general, I often trust the automatic exposure settings of the camera because it does a fairly good job. If you shoot right into the sun, then that will usually work. Moonshots are a bit more of a problem because the camera sees all the dark in the sky and tries to make it brighter, and that ends up with washed out shots. Google the Looney 11, L-O-O-N-E-Y 11. That's a rule that you can apply to get the exposure right for moonshots if you want to do manual exposure there.
You'd have to be crazy to do that.
Looney, yeah.
Looney!
Martin on Twitter asks, what's the point of pancake lenses? Now, if you haven't heard of pancake lenses, it's nothing to do with food photography. They're just very short barrel lenses. They're much smaller than regular lenses, and that's kind of the main point of them. They are smaller, they're lighter. They're also often cheaper because they come with smaller lenses, smaller bits of glass in there, lens elements. So you end up, they end up weighing less and being lighter, being smaller. But sometimes that's also at the cost of image quality. Having said that, I have three or four different pancake lenses, and I'm just fine with them. So actually, for my walk around setup, I use a 40mm pancake, and that's just fine. Mick again has a tip, but also a question: is using the reflection off the top of a car or van cheating to create calm lake type pictures?
No,
of course not.
There's no such thing as cheating.
This is actually what I will do when there is rain, or when there was rain and there are puddles on the ground. I'll go all the way down very low with my camera right above a puddle and reflect a scenery in it, and it will look like it's an entire lake in front of you. So whatever does the trick, reflections are amazing in photos, and a car roof can do that job. If you get really low down on the car, you will be able to, you got to have a clean car, of course, but then you will be able to make it look like it's from some water surface. Budman asks, do you have any good tutorials on manipulating RAW? So RAW photos from your camera need some processing. And I, a few years ago, did a Lightroom video workshop at discoverlightroom.com, which is still there.
And I own and I love.
It's a few years old, but it's still mostly current. And that's what Lightroom does. It is RAW manipulation. It is changing RAW files and kind of developing them. So that's
not all cameras will do RAW, but those that will, and some point in shoots will, are giving you just the data off the sensor, unmodified. That's kind of what you want.
The other thing is, if you have Lightroom and you are subscribed to their Creative Cloud, which is a monthly subscription, there is Lightroom Mobile. And if you import RAW files into your smartphone, you can actually edit RAW files on your smartphone using Lightroom.
Love it.
But you have to be subscribed to the Creative Cloud. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
I like it on the iPad Pro. That's actually kind of the perfect Lightroom tool, in a way.
And it's very capable, and it syncs with the desktop version. Again, you will need the Creative Cloud for that.
Russell Brown of Adobe told me that their ultimate goal is to make the mobile versions of Lightroom every bit as powerful as the desktop versions. And they're getting closer and closer.
I'd say they're about two-thirds there at this point. Well, maybe not quite, but they have the most important tools in there now. But, let's see where this goes. Snowdrops. Ask a great question. How do you create a picture of red flowers with a phone without redding out?
What's redding out?
That's the best term. That's the best. I've never heard this before, but it makes perfect sense. The red channel in your camera is the one that will most likely overexpose. So you will have like a beautiful flower, but on the photo, it turns into just a red blob. It doesn't have any detail left in it. So it's an overexposure of the red channel pretty much. And the best way to deal with that is by finding a way to change the exposure on your phone to lower the exposure. So you will want to try, sometimes it's a tap on the screen. On an iPhone, you tap on the screen, hold it for a few seconds, and then you get this yellow box, and next to it, there's an exposure slider. So you can slide it down and bring the exposure down a bit. It might look too dark on your screen then, but it will avoid the redding out. I love this. I'll use this from now on. And last but not least, there's a quick tip by Mick. You can see if your TV remote is working by looking through your SLR. Not through the viewfinder, though, but through the live view on the back, because the digital cameras usually see infrared. So you point the remote into the lens and look on the screen in the back. And with quite a few cameras, you will actually see little red light flashing because your camera can see infrared and your eye cannot.
Wow. Chris Marquardt, cool. A fountain of knowledge and wisdom. And he's off to Siberia. I can't help but
laugh. I'll be back.
Find out more about Chris and his work at discoverthetopfloor.com. He says he'll be back, but if not, he'll be doing the show from the gulag. And actually, we'll be back next week. And don't forget our assignment. Get out there. Take some pictures of break, whatever that means to you. Chris, have a great trip.
Thank you.
Yeah, stay warm and dry, and we'll see you in a few weeks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this.
You're out.
Nice. Wow, good is that timing. All for me? Well, you're going to have a great time. Look at this. I don't know if I need all this. Holy cow. So when do you leave? Thank you, baby.
On Saturday.
Nice. Introducing nice.
I'll bring stories and photos.
Are you taking a plane?
Yeah. We'll fly to Moscow and then from Moscow to
train?
Irkutsk.
Do you fly to Irkutsk? No.
It's a flight. It's a S7 Airlines flight.
They still do the Trans-Siberian Express. I've always wanted to do that. Oh, that'd be
they
so
do,
cool.
And in the old days, in winter they put the rails over the lake, over the frozen lake. They don't do this anymore.
That's
but they
my
used
goal.
To do this.
I love trains. When I retire, I'm gonna. If they're still around, you know, because these old classic train lines are dying. But
I want to do the Trans-Siberian one. One day I want to do that.
Oh. Yeah. Well, have a great time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
See you in 3 weeks.
You bet. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. To learn
more. Trans-Siberian Express. Isn't that like a Kraftwerk song? I feel like it is. Trans-Europe Express. Los Angeles area college that had to pay. I am going around the world. I mean, I must have it here. Do you? Nathan always played the music off YouTube. Do you play it off YouTube or?
Some stuff off YouTube, but most of it I have played from what we have.
Oh, you have it. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, most of it.
Oh, I'm thinking of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Inexpensive.
Yeah, that's what my car did at Christmas. It played a song from the Trans-Siberian Orchestra and did a light show. That was wild.
Christmas album, right?
Yeah. Here, I'll show you. Well,
I think I put that on your best of, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, the Christmas time best of.
Oh, fun. Thank you. Oh, I never did thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. It was fun putting that together.
Oh, good. I'm glad it wasn't horrible. Here is, I think I have a video. Oh, it's not on my YouTube channel. Where did I put that video? Oh, maybe it's on Facebook. Yeah, it's on Facebook. Should really put it on YouTube. Of my car.
Model Xmas. We're ready for the Model Xmas. Hold on. You guys can get a little closer if you want.
Yeah, I'm going to get my phone out.
Here's another Tesla Easter egg. And Leo's taking his time to get his phone out for me. And the boys are waiting patiently.
Ready?
All right, here we go. Dun da da da.
Wait till you see the doors. Fly in a second. Look, I know I'm playing Christmas music. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. Clyde on the line from Torrance, California. Hello, Clyde.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, got a problem. My wife and I both have Apple 5C on AT&T.
Okay.
And she also has an iPad.
Okay. What color is the... Do you have different colors on your 5Cs?
No, it's got a different color. Cases.
Yeah. I like the 5C was nice. That was the one with the color back. I don't know why Apple didn't keep doing that. That was really cool.
Yeah, that's right. I have to lay mine upside down when I lay it down so I can remember.
Which is which.
I know which one.
Whose is whose. Yeah. My wife and I do that, too. We fight over who gets the next color.
Yeah, we went to ugly cases here in Torrance.
There, that's a good way. What are your cases?
I got a blue one, and she's got a purple one, and they're different.
Yeah.
But they all work good.
Good.
We just started having a problem. She can text me, but I can't text her. If I text her, it comes in on her iPad, but
right.
Not her iPhone.
Yep. This is normal.
Oh, is this normal?
This is normal.
I've been looking online.
Apple's funny with this iMessage is it is tied to your Apple account.
Yeah,
and the reason they do that, I mean, normally, it's confusing because normally a phone texts a phone number.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you'd send a text message from a phone, you send it to a phone number, and that's what sees it. But Apple wanted it so that their messaging app would work on the Mac, on the iPad, on other phone, you know, just everywhere. So every device that is signed into that particular Apple account will get the message.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure that your phone and your tablet, and if you have a Mac and your Mac, are all on the same iCloud account or Mac.com account or me.com.
Wait a minute. That's more complicated because we're on an account with our daughter who lives in Texas.
Which means she's going to get your text messages too.
It could be.
I guarantee you. It can be very embarrassing. My father-in-law was getting our text messages for about 6 months. He didn't tell us.
Well, okay. I need to text not only her, but her three daughters.
Yeah, they're all... You need to make a new account, my friend. And you need to have a unique account for you and your wife. Otherwise, you'll be texting yourself.
Well, I can contact them.
Can go online and make a new account. It's easy to do. Just go online, make a new account, and then sign out. You go to your settings on the iPhone and go to the iCloud settings and sign out. There's a sign out button, and then sign into the new account.
Well, will that interfere with the economics of being on the same account with my daughter?
Well, there's a tech. The reason you did that right was so that you could share apps.
Yeah.
So there's family sharing. So what you'll do instead, Apple realized that people were doing this, and they said, "Well, we got to fix this." So what you'll do instead is add them to your family sharing account, and then they can get your apps.
Well, I don't.
But they're not on the same account. Apple is. It's not your fault. Apple is not very clear about this, and they ought to be. Each user should have their own account.
Yeah.
Well, my son was on my account for a while, and I was getting his text messages from college. That was interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm not, two of these girls are working girl. One's a working girl, and
so are some of my son's friends. Apparently, yeah.
But they don't. I don't get their mail.
No. Well, so yeah, it's it's confusing. I don't really understand. I don't think Apple understands how it all works. But this much I know: you need to have separate accounts for each user.
I wonder if I go to the Apple Store and
yeah, they'll help you. They know it's a stupid plan.
Okay.
They know it. Now, here's how I do it, which isn't necessarily the best way, but here's how I do it. I have two Apple accounts, one for the iTunes Store, stuff I buy. That's my family sharing account. And then I have my iCloud account. That's where my email, calendar, contacts, and phone are. Mm-hmm. And that way, I separate the family sharing and the apps from my data. But that's not a requirement. In fact, Apple kind of discourages that when you first sign in. It's in very fine print. If you want to use a different account for iTunes, well, you can do that here. They hide that because they really just want you to make one account. Why? Well, think about it. They would love to know everything you do.
Yeah.
They want to aggregate that all together. So they want to know what apps you buy as well as all the stuff you do on the other stuff. So they'd like one account, at least one account per person, though.
Well, there's something. Yesterday, I was at my desktop, And I disconnected my iPhone from my Wi-Fi and from cellular, and I sent an email to my text. You know, there's a way to do that. I sent a text from my email
right.
to me, and it came to me.
Yeah.
Then I sent one to her, and it came on her cell phone, but not on her iPad.
Right, because each account, once you set up the account, you associate phone numbers and email addresses with it.
Yeah.
So you can have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, but you want each account to have its own set. Otherwise, the messages. So if you had the same email address, you would have gotten it. You know, everybody would have gotten it too.
Yeah.
So it's just I. You know what? It is not your fault. I am baffled by it. I'm confused by it, and I can tell Apple doesn't really understand either.
So that's what I learned online.
Because you talk to Apple support, and they give you conflicting answers on the whole thing. It's a mess.
So I would save time to go to their store here locally.
Yeah, that's what the geniuses are for.
Fumbling around on the internet because everything is gobbledygook.
Yep.
And they talk about a different operating system and everything.
No. And they're really the one thing Apple's done so well is the support in the Apple stores is excellent.
Yeah.
So they're very gentle. They don't, you know, I'm sure inside they're laughing.
Yeah. I've been there with my granddaughter, and we've been over there several times.
Yeah, no, they're great. And that's, I tell you, that's why you pay extra for Apple stuff, is the Apple support is superb.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
And can I ask you, I'm getting a problem. I get a blue screen, and it's they say you're trying to open up a DPC, and I've been online trying to figure out how to overcome those codes. And again, I could spend half a day looking at that stuff, and nothing ever works.
You're going to get me started now.
Yeah, well,
This is Microsoft should not be telling you. You're getting a DPC. That stands for Defer Procedure Call.
Yep.
And it's nothing you can do anything about, and it only is designed to obfuscate and confuse.
Yep.
And the blue screen, basically, your computer should just be saying, I can't go on. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. Please reboot.
Well, I'm saying I have reprogrammed a couple of computers.
Oh, you know a few things then. All right.
But I don't like it, but am I going to have to do it eventually?
You mean like restore Windows, erase, and start over? There's Reviver Soft has a continuing series on blue screen of death errors, the chat room just sent me, that talks about the DPC watchdog violation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's more than that. This is a limited article because DPC could be a variety of device drivers.
Well, they say
it's the solid state drive, but it could be a lot of other things.
Well, maybe I'll.
Do you have a solid state drive?
Yeah, I'm going to replace the hard drive. It's several years old, and I've got a new one there setting to put in. Maybe I'll just start all over with a new hard drive.
Well, actually, it says even if you don't have an SSD, you may see this error. Yeah, a new hard drive with a new operating system. Will surely fix that problem.
I'm not as fast as you. That's why it takes me so long to do that.
I'm getting slower myself, Clyde.
Okay. We'll get in touch with you again.
Hey, it's a pleasure talking to you.
I'm a ham too, but I'm not going to give you a call letter.
Well, I'll give you mine. Not that I'm ever on the air. W6TWT. You know, I realized I got the general license and I got all the equipment. Then I realized, what am I doing? I talk on the air all day, every day. Why would I ever want to go home and go on the radio?
Well, to be different, you should just use CW.
I want to. That's what I want to do. Are you a Morse code guy?
Oh, yeah. I went to I did this 35 years
ago. Oh, you had to know Morse code.
Years ago.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I want to do. That's exactly. You nailed it. That's what I want to do. I want to do that.
Well, I'll end with this. I've told my family that if I'm ever paralyzed and can't talk, as long as I can move a finger wink at them, they better learn Morse code.
Okay. Clyde, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for calling. 7-3, my friend. That much I know. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up. Hour 3, right after the news from your local stations. Bye-bye.
You're out.
You know, Art Bell would do 4 hours, then he'd get on his ham set and talk all night. I don't have that much of a hankering to talk. But when I retire, that's probably what I'll do. I'll say, it's the tech guy on the air. Anybody out there? QSL. Talk to me. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, virtual reality, self-driving vehicles, anything with a chip in it. Well, I shouldn't say anything with a chip in it because people are testing me now. Well, I wonder, can you help me with my microwave? Okay, some limits. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere. The website is techguylabs.com, techguylabs.com. Roger on the line from Pasadena. He's our next caller. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Well, I've got a big problem. My Windows 10 computer had a complete meltdown a couple weeks ago. And they took it in the shop. I trust the shop. I've been going good. There for a long time.
No, it's good. Boy, you're lucky. If you've got a good shop,
yeah,
that's great.
So he had to reinstall Windows, and he did that. It worked fine for about a week. But okay. Now I'm getting a lot of problems with freezing. Sometimes it can't see all the drives on the
computer. Yeah, so thank the shop because they did the diagnostic, which is to see if it was a software issue. It's not. Right? Now we know it's hardware because it's still broken even though he replaced Windows.
Right.
So freezing and hard drive issues.
And sometimes File Explorer just kind of seems to go south and can't see anything.
When it freezes, what does that mean? Does the mouse stop moving?
No, the mouse still moves, but applications will freeze.
Yeah.
If I try to close them, they won't close.
Okay. So it's very the ways the computer fail are often informative as to what's gone wrong. The reason I asked you if the mouse had frozen is that's a different kind of freeze. That's the computer locking up.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening to you really is almost certainly the hard drive itself, which is good news because that's an easy part to replace.
Hmm.
So hard drives, if they fail or go wonky. Is it a solid state drive or a spinning drive? Do you know?
It's a solid state drive.
Solid state. Well, I might have to take this back. spinning drives, it's not all unusual for them to get less reliable. And what the symptoms of that are slowdowns, big slowdowns. Because what happens is the operating system is trying to read a sector. I cannot go on until I read this particular part of the drive. And it just keeps trying, which means everything else is just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very commensurate with the kinds of slowdowns and not really freeze isn't the word, but almost locked up that you're having. But if it's a solid state drive, usually the way solid state drives fail looks a little different. It could be the drive. How old is the computer? It's pretty new.
Well, the computer itself is only a couple of years old. The solid state drive is about a year old.
Yeah.
I did look at the properties of the Windows folder on that drive, and a number of those folders are shown as read only, and I didn't know if that.
All right, so yeah, I would say it's time to replace the drive.
Okay,
it's fortunately very cheap. You can even, since you've got a good tech.
Mm-hmm.
If you told him what you just told me, he would have the same conclusion.
Hmm.
He'd go, okay, well, I got it. You always want to try replacing Windows first because you want to eliminate software costs.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've done that, and he did that in the most effective way, which is blast it out and start over, then you know it's a hardware issue. And the only question is where. Now, there are other things you could consider, and he will think about. Memory problems, flaky motherboard. Usually that would lock up the mouse, though, you know, that kind of crash. Power supply issues. All of those can cause similar symptoms, but what this really sounds like is dramatic pauses or slowdowns.
Yeah.
And that's usually hard drive issues, reading the hard drive.
Hmm.
One way he could test it, and he'll know this, I'm sure, is to run an operating system not from the hard drive but from a USB key. You can download a free, you could do this, download a free copy of Linux like Ubuntu, put it on a USB key. Almost all the current versions of Linux have what they call live CDs. That mean you can run them off the USB key, not hit your hard drive at all. And if you run it off, you know, it's going to be slower because it's not a high-speed drive. It's just a USB key. But if you don't get these same weird major slowdowns and hesitations, that really does mean it's the hard drive. Because you haven't eliminated memory, you haven't eliminated power supply, you know, the motherboard is still, all those things. See, troubleshooting is a process of elimination. You slowly eliminate the things you can easily eliminate. And as Sherlock Holmes once said, whatever remains, Watson, however unlikely, is the solution. So that's what I would start with, the hard drive. That's one of the most common problems. Usually SSDs, typically the way SSDs fail is abruptly and dramatically. Because they don't have the same situation a magnetic drive has where you can kind of read it. You either can or can't read an SSD cell. So, but a hard drive, you know, cells can get, or sectors, the equivalent, can get harder to read, which slows everything down as it tries harder to read them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, back to the shop, I guess.
Yeah, he'll know what to do in this. This is exactly the kind of ongoing process that you have to go through if a problem, you have problems with a computer.
Yeah.
It could be something else, but if he's you got a good guy, that's great. He'll be able to figure it out. Okay. You may have, you know, his problem with it, you know, there is most computers have some form of diagnostics. Windows 10 has diagnostics, but they're of dubious value. They can't always tell what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think swapping the drive out or trying it, you know, if he's in a shop, he could just take a different drive and try it without any cost, you know, just the cost of his time and see if that's the problem.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. Yep. I would say the single most common issue with PCs is a hard drive issue. And the symptoms are slowdowns, unreliability, oddball crashes, all of those things. Stan in Irvine, you're next. Hi, Stan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, hi. Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Stan. Thanks for calling.
You ready for my question?
I couldn't be more ready. I was born ready. Well, that's not true. But
I upgraded my computer and software, and I can't open the .xls files with Excel 2016, Windows 10.
What happens? Are you double-clicking the files?
Well, it has something to do with the Trust Center.
The Trust Center? Ooh, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah.
So there's two ways to open an Excel file. One is, of course, as with all document files, you double-click or open the document. And Windows has a database that says, oh, it's an XLS file. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I open Excel. It'll then open Excel and load the file. The other way is to open Excel manually, go to the file menu, and load that file. Have you tried that method?
Yes.
And you get the same error.
Yes, the problem is they have this Trust Center, and so I'm really trying to take Excel 97 to 2003 and open it. And if you look at the Microsoft, there's a whole bunch of discussion of people who can't do this, and they all have critical .xls files that they can't open.
So the Trust Center is part of Office, and it's important because Excel files, Word files, can have content from other files embedded in them. And the reason that there's some security concern is because, you know, you don't want to just willy-nilly load content from the net and execute it, or load a macro from another file and execute it. That could be problematic. So that's why the Trust Center is complaining. I got to take a break. Hang on. I'll give you the workaround when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
So we're still here, actually. We're just not on the radio. But I can I can still help you, Stan, because I have miracle powers. So
I'm looking at the the file block settings right now.
Yeah. So you can just enable it and say, don't block it. From now on, I want to enable all content. That's risky. There's a reason why the Trust Center is blocking it. But if you are sure that
yes, I am.
You are, then I would just go into the Trust Center and enable all content for that file.
Well, it has something called file block settings.
Yeah.
And it says by selecting save, Excel prevents saving in this file type. And
right. So you have to make it a trusted document. It's an untrusted document.
Right.
So it has content, what's called active content in it, that Microsoft... It's not that Microsoft knows the content's dangerous. It just knows that this is a common pathway for infections. So yes. It tries to protect you. So, but if you are sure that the file is safe and that the content it accesses is safe, that's really important because it might have a URL in there or something. But you know where it came from and the macro or the links are safe, then you can enable it. Make it a trusted document.
So, well, I tried that, but the table is sort of confusing because I've tried it with checking, like...
Well, here's what Microsoft says in their support document. You've got the document. Click the File tab. Click Info. There'll be a Security Warning section. And in there, you'll have an option. There's an option that says Enable All Content.
Oh.
And that will unblock it. So you have to go to the Security Warning section of the File Info document dialog.
Not the Trust Center?
No. You got to do it from the from Excel in the file.
Well, this Trust Center is for Excel.
Yeah, I understand. So are you getting the yellow warning that says security warning?
No. Well, what it does, it just flashes.
Yeah.
You see a file, it just flashes and it disappears.
Yeah.
Now, there was some way I could do it by selecting the proper items, and I could save it in the later, the current format.
Right. And at that point, it'll be trusted, I think, if you save it separately like that. But if not, go into File Info in Excel, go into File Info, and in the Security Warning section, you could just say, look, I trust this. Everything in here is trustworthy. Don't give me this warning ever again.
And where are these settings you're talking about?
Under the file, let's see. And I'm looking at Office Support. Actually, you could do this in the Trust Center. You have the Trust Center open. Let me look here.
Yeah, and there is, they say, there's a Microsoft knowledge base, R922850. There's all sorts of communication notes back and forth with
So
people.
Don't read all those. That's everybody else's issue.
Right.
So when you try to open file types created in previous versions of Office, the file will open by default, this is what's happening to you, in protected view. File block prevents outdated file types from opening and causes your file to open in protected view and disables save and open. Is that what's happening to you?
Yes.
Yes.
I can't open it or save it. Now, I was able to do it before I went on vacation.
Yeah. Hold on. We're coming back, so I'll walk you through it here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. On the line with us, Stan, he's got a file he can't open, and this is actually a safety security feature in Microsoft Office. It lets you open a file from a previous version of Office, but it puts it in protected mode so that it can't infect you. See, there were a number of viruses that used Office macros to infect you, and in an Excel spreadsheet, you can also embed content from the web. Links to other data and so forth. And that means that potentially that's unsafe content. So it puts it by default in a protected mode that keeps you from getting infected, but also keeps you from doing anything. So you can make and Stan, this is what I'm reading from. This is a support document. So if you Google okay, you're getting a toll-free call. So I'll let you do that, but I'll put this in the show notes, techguylabs.com. But if you go to office support, support.office.com, and you search for what is a file block, it explains how you can go into the Trust Center in the file block area, and you can change the options on that particular file or all files in future. I wouldn't recommend changing it forever. I would do it on a file-by-file basis because you really do want to verify that that file is, you know, all yours. Nothing else is in there, no macros, no viruses. And Microsoft, you know, this is one of the things Microsoft's done. There are many in response to, you know, the security issues Windows has had and Office has had for some time. They also do this in Outlook in their mail program. They will keep you from, executing stuff. You know, they'll keep you from seeing files in your email, things like that, seeing images. All of this is to protect you from, you know, viruses and stuff that's coming off of the internet. So in an Office program, if you go to File Options and you open up the Trust Center, and in the Trust Center settings, you'll see File Block Settings. And in the file type list, you can say, I want to turn this protective mode off for just this file or for all time. Again, do it just for that file, unless you know you're never going to get a bad file. Joe, Orange County, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm just startling here with the internet.
Well, the internet. I've heard of that.
I'm trying to extend my Wi-Fi from upstairs to downstairs because I don't know if there's, you know, the walls or what is it, but I'm not able to make a DirecTV, which is downstairs, grab the internet, you know, the Wi-Fi signal from upstairs in the house.
Well, you know, this seems to be a common problem. A common problem. So, in fact, there's a whole new category of Wi-Fi routers aimed at this particular problem. So I talked about this on the last show. We had a great caller. He was 10 years old. His name was Cody. My Wi-Fi doesn't go upstairs. So you should get together with Cody because his won't go upstairs. Yours won't go downstairs. Between the two of you, you could probably make that work. No, I'm kidding. I'll give you the same advice I gave Cody. There are there's three ways to do this. So you have your Wi-Fi is upstairs because that's where the cable comes into the wall.
Correct.
And that's where your box is, your mm-hmm. router box, and you're connected to your router is a Wi-Fi access point. Sometimes they're both the same device.
And it's a combined, you know.
Yeah, that's what they give you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, someday we'll talk about how to get rid of that. But there's antennas on it, right? Little antennas coming out of it.
Not really. On this one, there's no antennas.
It's no antennas? Well, no wonder you can't get a signal. How does it work without antennas? Well, putting an internal antenna in is dumb, but okay. So most Wi-Fi access points now will have one, two. Mine has six, count them, antennas. Thing looks like an upside-down spider.
Okay.
Although, as you know, spiders have eight legs, right? Yes. Okay, I'm just checking. So it's not a spider. It's a wounded spider. Anyway, it's not a good look. So, but those are helpful. They give you more distance. Now, that thing isn't. Here's the analogy I used for Cody. You've all seen when you throw a rock into a pond, the ripples that come off of it. The rock is your access point. Your Wi-Fi signal is those ripples. And here's a reason I use that analogy. There's a couple of ways to fix this problem. One would be to have another wired connection. So you can get out of the back of your router, there's probably an Ethernet jack. You could, if you had means, some way to drill a hole in the floor, put a wire downstairs and have another access point down there. That's one way. And that would, in effect, have another rock and a separate set of ripples. That's one way to do it. Most expensive, most complicated, but probably the most effective. Other way to do it is with a Wi-Fi extender. And what that does is you put that kind of midway between where you can't get Wi-Fi and where you can get Wi-Fi. So you put it where the ripples are starting to die out, but they haven't died out yet. And it just amplifies the ripples.
Okay.
Generally, if you're going to do a Wi-Fi extender, you want to buy it from the same company that made the base station. You got yours from the cable company. Is it cable or DSL? Or what kind of?
No, it's cable. Cable. It's Cox cable.
So you got the Cox box. And I don't know even who makes the Cox box. But so this is another, that would be another way to do it. And you'd have to figure out what extenders, you can do a little Googling, what extenders work with it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The new way is kind of interesting. And it's called mesh.
Okay.
And in essence, the way a mesh works is there's the rock, there's the ripples, and then the rock has a separate connection, wireless, to another rock in another part of the house that creates its own ripples. So it has, in effect, two wireless connections, a connection you can see and a separate hidden connection to another router. And that router can connect to another router, can another router. And so you can spread the ripples everywhere. And these mesh systems work very well for large houses, long-distance throws, situations where, because of walls or doors or stuff in the way, Wi-Fi just gets blocked. They're similar to an extent. They feel very similar to a Wi-Fi extender, but they're subtly different, and they work better. Lots of companies are making these now. Google makes it. Google's Wi-Fi is a mesh system. Eero, E-E-R-O, they're a sponsor of some of our podcast. Little disclaimer there, but they make an excellent system. The thing you'll notice is these are all much more expensive than your cheap Linksys router. The one I use at home is a hybrid system called an Orbi. It's from Netgear. It has two units, works very well. It's a little less expensive because it only has two instead of most of these have three units.
Okay.
The advantage of an Eero or a Google is you can add more units. You can continue to add units till you've covered everything. So, I mean, now the Eero will – now there's a third one that I just ordered and I'm going to be testing, but I've read very good things about it. It's from a really well-known enterprise Wi-Fi company called Ubiquiti. That's Ubiquiti with an I at the end instead of a Y.
Oh, okay.
They make the Amplify HD, and I'm hearing – and Gadget just reviewed it, said it's the best of the bunch. So I'll be trying it and reviewing it. Same idea. You have a base unit, and then you have two satellite units. All of the mesh systems have apps that you put on your phone that help you place them, that also help you manage the network. In my opinion, this is the new way and the best way to solve this problem. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Wow, that was a lot of talking. So did that all make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. I have a Netgear extender.
Yeah, and that works best if your cable modem is a Netgear. I don't know if it is.
No, I don't think it is. Yeah. I'm not there right now.
But it may still work. Let me see what Cox uses. The other way to do that is, for instance, if you're going to do the mesh thing, and I didn't mention this, you're going to want to disable the Cox router. Not you, the modem you still need, but you don't need. You don't want to use their router. So.
And what if you have like an extender? Because I have old extenders where you have to actually. But plug in the Ethernet. So you plug the Ethernet to the router, then to the outlet, and then from another outlet you.
Yeah, that's called power line. So it uses your power lines in the house like Ethernet. There's a disadvantage to that because they're noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I did is I tried. Okay, I'm going to connect that to the router. I have a Cisco router. But
yeah. So what you can do, and this is probably the best thing to do, is get a router, or rather a cable modem that Cox approves. Get rid of their junk, because it's junk. Send it back, and you'll eliminate the monthly fee. By the way.
Yeah. No,
and buy your own.
Yeah. That's
cable modems are cheap.
Yeah.
So they have a list of Cox certified cable modems. Get one of those. It should be DOCSIS 3. That's the standard you want to for maximum speed. DOCSIS 3.
Okay.
Apparently Cox uses Netgear. They're telling me in the chat room. But get a Motorola Surfboard or something like that. An Aeris modem. That's what I use, the Aeris. And then it doesn't do any routing. It just translates into Ethernet. Then you get one of these mesh systems, plug it into the back, and it's going to do all the routing, all the Wi-Fi. Mesh systems need to be doing the routing to be most effective. And the reason is they're doing all sorts of fancy quality of service and load balancing. They're very tricky. And they want to know everything there is about the connection. So if they have to go through a router, they don't work as well. I mean, they'll work, okay, but they don't get to do QoS and stuff. So you really want them to route as well as Wi-Fi. Now, the problem is, of course, these mesh solutions are hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, I'm looking right now. You know, doing the
yeah. The Orbi's been very good. How big is your house?
No, it's a 2,700 square feet house. It's
yeah, not- that's why. But you know, a lot of these solutions are good for 1,500 square feet.
Yeah, because it's in one side of the house, and then I need the internet in the
right.
other side of the
right.
house.
Right, right.
So, yeah. So I've tried, and they say, you know, I had the old Aris
right.
set, that, because I moved from...
You don't want the old one, though, because the standards have updated.
Yeah, so I still have the old one, but I you know, they came in and say, oh, this is the newest one. It's a 5G, and
oh.
it's all in one.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But no.
But the problem is it's got the Wi-Fi too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What happened when you did the Netgear extender? Did it work?
It did. It did.
Good.
But then I did it at the beginning, right? But then I connect again to the DirecTV and try to do something, and it's like, oh, no internet connection.
I have to
reconnect it again, and I'm like, oh, come on, if I'm going to have to do this every single time, it's like very annoying.
I think that's the Cox box. You know, as routers don't age well. In a couple of years, they burn out. That's why I don't like using the cable modems, because they don't – the cables companies, because they don't change them out. You know, they – that somebody else had that, and somebody else before them, so – you kind of want to get a new one that you own, in my opinion. I got to run, but thank you. Good luck. You're not alone. This has become a mass market. So, you know, I gave a little more advice to our last caller about extending your Wi-Fi. This is such a universal problem. And really, I think the main reason is just congestion. If you open your computer and you look at the Wi-Fi signals it sees, if you live in a city, or worse, an apartment building, you'll see, you know, quite a few other Wi-Fi routers, and the band just gets congested. It's a lot of interference. These mesh systems seem to handle that better. For one thing, what they do automatically, all of them, is they switch back and forth between 2.4 gigahertz, which is the most congested band, and 5 gigahertz, and they do it transparently. So they'll pick the best frequency, the least congested, and within that frequency, the best channel. And they do a better job than you would do it manually, I think. And they do it on the fly all the time, and they're constantly adjusting. The negative, of course, in all these mesh systems is they're around $300, more or less. And we're used to spending $40 for a cheap Linksys router. In my opinion, it's worth spending a little more. There's nothing worse than bad internet. Or I don't mean non-internet. I mean flaky internet, where it comes and goes and kind of works, and your kids are yelling at you, and you're frustrated. It's just, you know, to me, it's worth a couple $100 not to have my kids yell at me, right? Yeah. 8888, ask Leo. That's the phone number. Alan in Santa Rosa is next. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How's the rain treating you?
Oh, I'm inside, so I'm not bothered by it at all.
Yeah, we had a pretty wet winter in Northern California this year.
Yeah, been loving it, though.
You know, I'm just down the road a piece in Petaluma, you know. You should come by and say hi.
I just might do that one.
I'd love it. What can I do for you?
Okay, I've been a Mac user since 2009, and I love it. No problem with that as far as I'm concerned, but my wife struggles. And on yesterday's show, you were talking about the new Samsung Chromebook. And my question is, would that be a solution to simplify her life?
Yes. yes, anybody's life.
Yeah, but to take it a step further, my problem with doing it is I don't want to store my data on the web.
Right.
I just have a problem.
I understand that, and that is You don't have to. They have storage. The Chromebook Plus that I mentioned has 32 gigabytes. But Chromebooks really are designed to be cloud devices. And when you say cloud, you mean the internet. They're designed to keep your documents on the internet and keep your email on the internet, keep your contacts and your address book on the internet in Google's cloud. So if you have an aversion to that, can I talk you out of your aversion to that? Can I reassure you?
Yeah, when I was in the workforce, I didn't even do direct deposit payroll because I didn't want all that out there like that.
I completely sympathetic. In the modern world, the internet is a big part of our lives. And unfortunately, it isn't very secure for privacy. In fact, the FCC just threw out privacy rules for your telcos and your internet carriers. It's getting worse. Not only is it government snooping on you, it's companies snooping on you, and it's bad guys snooping on you.
I decided
to live with it because of the convenience offered. For instance, with a Chromebook, if you lose the Chromebook, you just get another one and log in, and it's all there.
My problem was not so much running the Chromebook and updating the software. I just was looking for a possibility of using a network attached storage or personal web.
It's funny because I do that for my notes and for my documents. I store them locally and sync them. Remember, though, you'd have to have secure syncing. You're hoping that the company that's making this device, I use a Synology, has done its homework and its software doesn't have flaws and they're keeping it up to date because no software is perfect because there's, always that potential. I really could argue that your wife would be safer using a Chromebook because if you use a Windows machine, you're also a target, as you know, for bad guys. And it's very common that people get bit. Whereas Google does a very good job with security, and the Chromebook is very secure. There's no malware on the Chromebook. And so I would argue you're safer doing your banking on a Chromebook than you are on a Windows machine, a lot safer.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just reevaluate my thinking on that.
You're not storing anything super – if you want to keep stuff super private, I understand. I do completely understand. But for your wife, what is she – if she's probably not doing anything that would be – as long as nothing that you're doing on this thing would be embarrassing for your kids or your parents or your loved ones to see, I don't think there's any what's the harm?
She just uses it for the web and email.
And by the way, your email is like sending a postcard. Everybody can read it along the way.
Yeah.
Right? Already your email is on the cloud. That's the definition of email. The web, guess where the web lives? On the cloud. So a lot of what she's doing, most people do, is already in the internet. And your internet service provider sees everything. So I figure, I trust Google a lot more than I trust my internet service provider. And I think that they fight for your privacy with government. I think that they protect you as best they can in a difficult climate.
Okay.
So I'm willing to take the chance, and I do think you're so much safer that that's something to absolutely consider.
Okay. I will do that then. Thank you.
You're welcome. No, very thoughtful, and you're absolutely right. And for years, I stored my data on, my files on Dropbox, a public cloud service. I stored my notes, my data, my serial numbers, my passwords, even my passport in Evernote, a public, secured, but, public note-taking service. I keep all my passwords, my most precious data, in something called LastPass, which saves it all in the cloud. So, I'm very aware of this. And lately I've been moving my notes and my documents off of public clouds into my own private cloud in my house and sync up with that securely with an encrypted connection and all of that. But, my passwords are still on LastPass. And there's a reason for that. It's convenient to have access to my passwords on all my devices. And if they didn't store the password file, suitably encrypted. I feel confident that bad guys and government can't get into it. Only I have the key to it. LastPass doesn't have the key to it. Nevertheless, there's a risk. It's sitting out there. And if somebody were to get that, that's everything. That's the crown jewels. That's my, I shouldn't say this out loud, my banking passwords. I don't put passports in my Evernote anymore. I put it in the secured notes of LastPass. They're encrypted. But if somebody were to get that data file and bang on it and figure out that my password is monkey123, I would be in deep trouble. I didn't just say my password, did I? Oh, no. You know, I'm going to run. I'll be right back in a few minutes. And no, I'm just teasing. That's not my password. It's monkey1234. Our show will take a natural pause while I go change all my passwords. Coming up in just a moment, Dave, all the way from Hawaii. He's got an iPod. He wants to know what's next. We'll talk about that and lots more. One more segment to go as we continue talking about the wiles and the ways and the wiliest ways of the internet and the cloud. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thank goodness they don't know I spell monkey with a U. If they knew that, is my mic on?
You're out, Leo.
Thanks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. But actually, I shouldn't give it out because I think we're almost out of here for the week. What? Okay, that can't be true. Dave, you're next from Hawaii. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling from paradise.
Yeah, it does sound a little better than CA with all the rain you're getting.
Yeah, what island are you on?
Over on the Waikoloa side of the Big Island.
Oh.
The sunny side.
Nice.
Yeah, it's not bad.
You're looking at the ocean right now?
I can be.
Don't. That's all right. That makes me. I'll be jealous. That's not.
Yeah, it's a little breezy here today. We got some trades blowing, but all in all, it's pretty nice. I have a decidedly low tech question. I'm going the other way from everyone else here.
You got an iPod?
Yeah, and I love it. And I'm old school. If it's not broke, why fix it? You know.
I still have a bunch of iPods. Exactly.
Well, then let me buy them from you.
Over my dead body. You know what I did when they discontinued the Classic? I went out and got a couple, the 160 gig Classic, because I knew there wouldn't be anything like that again.
How did you know that? I mean, if they work so good, and even people like you are like hoarding them, why doesn't Apple make them again?
Because you guys won't buy them. It's just you know.
No, I've talked to a few people.
Okay, you and your friends.
Yeah.
Have you looked at iPod sales lately?
No, I don't.
Yeah. So you could just think of, imagine a graph. There's two lines. There's one that's going straight up to the moon. That's the iPhone. And exactly in the same direction, in the same angle, in the opposite direction is iPod sales. So the iPhone, for most people, replaced the iPod. Who's going to buy both an iPhone and an iPod, right?
Well, but like if you're out just walking around your yard, you know, mowing.
You don't
your
have
lawn.
To explain it to me. I own them. I love them.
But it's so small. It's compact. It's got all your music.
You know, 1,000 songs in your pocket. Can you believe that?
I know. I mean,
I'll tell you the other thing that's killed the iPod.
What?
Nobody wants to own music anymore. They want to stream it. They pay $10 a month for Apple Music or Spotify or. Mm-hmm. And they have 30 million songs in their pocket, and they think that's fine.
Yeah, I can dig that. Unfortunately, I got 30,000 songs worth of CDs.
And they're your music. And you know, yeah. It's funny. I was thinking this last night that what we've done by doing this is we've commoditized music. We've eliminated differentiation. When you, I had one of the highlights of my life. I had dinner with Paul Simon. And we were talking about Graceland. And this is a work of art. This is a work of art like the Mona Lisa, like the Venus de Milo. This is a thing that he created with whatever, 10, 11 songs on it, each of which he spent a long time thinking about, working on. And you hold it in your hand, and that's a work of art that he created. But for kids nowadays, music, and I think I know how this started, music is a service. It's not a thing. It's not a work of art. It's just a kind of continuous background sound. And I think we're to blame. You remember Muzak?
Yeah.
I think we, by creating elevator music and music everywhere, music constantly on, we created in our children's minds, and now their children are grown, this notion that music isn't a work of art. It's not a work at all. It's a constant river of sound, and they don't differentiate it. That's what I mean by commoditized.
And the music now isn't really built to last.
Well, and the music industry is going, oh yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah,
we'll make more. You know,
yeah,
bacon. We'll make more pork bellies.
And so the music I'm listening to is music that is still being played on the radio,
it has meaning to you though, right? Because those albums, you think about that album, you know where you were when you bought it, you know where you were when you listened to Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. You have a memory of it.
Yeah.
It's not commoditized. It's a particular thing. And I don't think we treat music that way anymore. It's all disposable.
I agree with you with that. It's definitely disposable music. So that said, I guess I'm just going to bite the bullet and buy an iPod Touch.
Still sell that thing?
Yeah, unless I, on the internet.
You know what an iPod Touch is? It's an iPhone without the phone.
I know. That's why I go and look at it at Costco, and it's got all this extra stuff on it.
I know.
I have a phone that does all that stuff. I just want something I can go out and put on my pocket, put on my wireless headphones, mow the lawn, and have just music on it. And so
there are, I would guess, still companies making MP3 players. I think SanDisk still makes them, for instance.
But you can't put your iTunes music on that, can you?
Well, Apple, you could, because Apple has eliminated copy protection. Because you bought stuff on iTunes, I take it, before they got rid of copy protection, you'll have to jump through some hoops to fix this.
Yeah.
But there is no copy protection anymore, which means your AAC files from Apple can be played on any device. So here's what you should do. There's a service Apple calls. It calls iTunes Match. $25.
Yep.
Gives you a year, but you won't need a year. You sign up for iTunes Match. It goes through your iTunes collection and matches it in the cloud. Right. If you have copy-protected music, it matches it with unprotected music. Everything you get is 256-bit unprotected AAC. If you have 128 kilobit MP3, I have many.
Yeah.
It'll turn it into a 256 kilobit unprotected AAC. Then what you do is you move your music collection somewhere else. You take it off your Mac and you download everything from iTunes Match. So now you've replaced your entire iTunes library with unprotected, high quality, still compressed, but higher quality AAC files. The only caveat there is sometimes the matches are wrong. So if you have a live, especially if it's an unusual live version of James Brown singing Sex Machine at the Apollo, and then they match it to the studio version,
right,
you'll be unhappy that you lost the original. It's happened to friends of mine. So don't throw out your music. Put it aside, and you can bring that stuff back.
Sure.
But this helps.
I could just put that on an external storage type thing.
Yeah, or an iPod.
Or an iPod, yeah.
But I would put it, exactly what I would do is put it on a separate drive. Yeah. And that way you've got it. That's your archive of all your original music. But this way you get rid of the copy protection. Now you can go out and get a Sansa clip or something. So the real only reason SanDisk still makes them is because they sell solid SSDs. And so it's just a way to sell more solid state memory. But and by the way, you can put it on a USB. There's a new category that might be saving this of high res music players. They play higher quality, uncompressed, and a number of companies make these, including Neil Young. He makes the Pono player, but there's others as well. And these are just like iPods. They play higher quality music back. They often have better headphone amps in them, better digital to analog converters in them, so the music is a little more pristine.
Yeah.
So if you're serious about your music, this is another good way to go.
That has intrigued me.
But I bought one from FIO, F-I-I-O, and I would look at that. They're very inexpensive. It looks just like a metal iPod.
Wow, that sounds like a cool tip.
Yep.
FIO, F-I-I-O.
Yep.
And then I just put everything up into the cloud.
Get the copy protection off of it.
Yeah, the iTunes Match, and then re-download it into my new device.
And you may want to, if you have the CDs as a long-term project, re-rip your CDs uncompressed. That way you can play them on the Fio device and you don't lose any quality. It's the same CD quality. Hey, thanks for the call. Thank you for letting an old man vent about kids today. Hey, we had fun today. Thanks to Michael Cozio. He's keeping music alive with his great musical bumpers, our musical director. Thanks to Kim Schaffer for answering all those calls. Thanks to all of you for calling and listening. I appreciate it, and I hope you'll come back next week. We'll do this all over again. TechGuyLabs.com is the website. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.